Have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
We have resolved that from today we will together manage the process of globalization to secure responsibility from all and fairness to all. And we've agreed that in doing so we will build a more sustainable and more open and a fairer global society.
The goal should be to devise a system of global financial governance.
There's a need for a new world order, but it has different characteristics in different parts of the world.
After 1989, President Bush said, and it's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order.
The ultimate and final objective is by means of a world revolution to establish the dictatorship of the so-called proletariat into one world union. In other words, what George Bush described as the new world order. Incredible to think that someone who has been espoused as a conservative Republican, George Bush, holds dearly to the beliefs of the Communist Party. I hardly ever talk about Bill and Hillary Clinton. They're hardly worth talking about. The Communist rules for revolution read like this. Ask yourself if any of these apply to today. Corrupt the young. Get them away from religion. Get them interested in sex. Make them superficial and destroy their ruggedness. If you like, you can take a pencil and just make a little check mark if it's already been done. Get control of all means of publicity. Get people's minds off their government by focusing their attention on athletics, sexy books and plays and trivialities. Divide the people into hostile groups by constantly harping on controversial matters of absolutely no importance. Tanya Harding, O.J. Simpson. We've spent 2 years
and said, hopefully I'll be remembered as the person who brought an end to Christianity.
My fellow Americans, we will no longer be oppressed by the fascism of Christianity, and we will no longer be oppressed by the fascism of beauty. Because I see you all sitting out there trying your hardest not to be ugly, trying your hardest not to fit in, trying your hardest to earn your way into heaven. But let me ask you, do you want to be in a place that's filled with a bunch of...
Furthermore, the character of Jesus being a literary and astrological hybrid is most explicitly a plagiarization of the Egyptian sun god Horus. For example, inscribed about 3,500 years ago on the walls at the Temple of Luxor in Egypt are images of the Annunciation, the miracle conception, the birth, and the adoration of Horus. The images begin with Thoth announcing to the virgin Isis that she will conceive Horus, then Neph, the Holy Ghost, impregnating the virgin, and then the virgin birth and the adoration. This is exactly the story of Jesus' miracle conception. In fact, the literary similarities between the Egyptian religion and the Christian religion are staggering. And the plagiarism is continuous. The story of Noah and Noah's Ark is taken directly from tradition. The concept of the Great Flood is ubiquitous throughout the ancient world, with over 200 cited claims in different periods and times. However, one need look no further for a pre-Christian source than the Epic of Gilgamesh, written in 2600 BC. This story talks of a great flood commanded by God, an ark with saved animals upon it, and even the release and return of a dove, all held in common with the biblical story, among many other similarities. And then there is the plagiarized story of Moses. Upon Moses' birth, it is said that he was placed in a reed basket and set adrift in a river in order to avoid infanticide. He was later rescued by a daughter of royalty and raised by her as a prince. This baby in a basket story was lifted directly from the myth of Sargon of Akkad of around 2250 BC. Sargon was born, placed in a reed basket in order to avoid infanticide, and set adrift in a river. He was in turn rescued and raised by Aki, a royal midwife. Furthermore, Moses is known as the lawgiver, the giver of the Ten Commandments, the Mosaic Law. However, the idea of a law being passed from God to a prophet up on a mountain is also a very old motif. Moses is just another lawgiver in a long line of lawgivers in mythological history. In India, Manu was the great lawgiver. In Crete, Minos ascended Mount Dicta, where Zeus gave him the sacred laws. While in Egypt, there was Mises, who carried stone tablets, and upon them the laws of God were written. Manu, Minos, Mises, Moses. And as far as the Ten Commandments, they are taken outright from spell 125 in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. What the Book of the Dead phrased, "I have not stolen," became "thou shalt not steal." "I have not killed" became "thou shalt not kill." "I have not told lies" became "thou shalt not bear false witness," and so forth. In fact, the Egyptian religion is likely the primary foundational basis for the Judeo-Christian theology. Baptism, afterlife, final judgment, virgin birth, death and resurrection, crucifixion, the Ark of the Covenant, circumcision, saviors, Holy Communion, Great Flood, Easter, Christmas, Passover, and many, many more are all attributes of Egyptian ideas long predating Christianity and Judaism. The Bible is nothing more than an astro-theological literary hybrid, just like nearly all religious myths before it. In fact, the aspect of transference of one character's attributes to a new character can be found within the book itself. In the Old Testament, there is the story of Joseph. Joseph was a prototype for Jesus. Joseph was born of a miracle birth. Jesus was born of a miracle birth. Joseph was of 12 brothers. Jesus had 12 disciples. Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver. Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver. Brother Judah suggests the sale of Joseph. Disciple Judas suggests the sale of Jesus. Joseph began his work at the age of 30. Jesus began his work at the age of 30. The parallels go on and on. Furthermore, is there any non-biblical historical evidence of any person living with the name Jesus, the son of Mary, who traveled about with 12 followers, healing people and the like? There are numerous historians who lived in and around the Mediterranean, either during or soon after the assumed life of Jesus. How many of these historians document this figure? Not one. However, to be fair, that doesn't mean defenders of the historical Jesus haven't claimed the contrary. Four historians are typically referenced to justify Jesus' existence. Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, and Tacitus are the first three. Each one of their entries consists of only a few sentences at best, and only referred to Christus or the Christ, which in fact is not a name but a title. It means the Anointed One. The fourth source is Josephus, and this source has been proven to be a forgery for hundreds of years. Sadly, it is still cited as truth. You would think that a guy who rose from the dead and ascended into heaven for all eyes to see and performed the wealth of miracles acclaimed to him would have made it into the historical record. It didn't, because once the evidence is weighed, there are very high odds that the figure known as Jesus did not even exist.
So is there anything else about the ruling class we should know? Politicians, business leaders, and media figures are often portrayed as pillars of morality while they describe themselves as Christian conservatives. Nothing could be further from the truth. In reality, many of the elite are groomed at a young age to take part in occult rituals. Those who attend Yale are indoctrinated into the Order of Skull and Bones, an elite secret society cloaked as a fraternal order.
Yale University is 300 years old this year, and were you to visit its campus, you would see that it still has exotic clubhouses, which look like tombs where Yale's legendary secret societies meet. Their prestige and importance have largely evaporated, but the rituals are still a secret. And so when we heard that some enterprising characters had managed to spy on the famous Skull and Bones Society, we couldn't resist.
Skull and Bones, people say it's a fraternity at Yale University, but it's really a postgraduate organization. So it was founded in 1832, and it's not like a normal fraternity. People don't pledge. These people choose who they want to come. So they do the recruiting. They recruit 15 people every year, people who they see are going to be powerful people in the future. So they're recruited when they're a junior in college. A lot of these people come from really wealthy and influential families because they know that this person has the resources to then elevate them to a position of power that can benefit the club.
The video shows the neophytes, or initiates, kissing a skull, then performing a mock human sacrifice. Horrific screams caught on tape include chants of, "The devil equals death, death equals the devil."
True. Famous alums include senators, John Kerry and John Chafee, to name two, cabinet secretaries, such as Averill Harriman, and three presidents, William Taft, George Bush, and George W. Bush, who's been reluctant to talk about Skull and Bones.
Does it still exist? The thing is so secret, I'm not even sure it still exists.
Former Skull and Bones members and current members have been presidents, heads of the CIA, senators, heads of business. I mean, huge, huge corporations. These people have the network that brings them to such a position of power that most people could only dream of.
Bush would run against his fellow Bonesman and distant cousin John Kerry in 2004.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets, Tim.
You were both in Skull and Bones, the secret society.
It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America? The conspiracy theorists are going to go wild.
I'm sure they are. I don't know. I haven't seen the web.
Number 322? This is an elaborate occult ritualistic entry into this group that they are now a member of for life.
This culture of death in the occult continues long after college. Later on in life, these pagan rituals carry on in the redwoods of Sonoma, California.
And what is the Bohemian Grove? Well, it's a kind of summer camp for the powerful, an all-male gathering in great secrecy.
This group was formed in the late 1800s by artists, industrialists, and politicians. Bohemian attendees worship the owl as their deity. The Aztecs, Mayans, and other natives of Mesoamerica consider the owl a symbol of destruction and death. This is why the opening ritual for the club is the cremation of care. During the ritual, the effigy of a baby is rowed across the water by the Grim Reaper and given to a high priest, who then tosses it on a fiery sacrificial altar of a 40-foot owl god. It is an earth-based ritual in which care is burned away. The conscience is symbolically cast aside so that they may ignore the pain they have inflicted on others, the advancement of their own agendas.
With this ceremony called the cremation of care, that begins the 2-week encampment where the body of dull care, symbolizing woes and concerns, is burned on an altar in front of a big owl statue. When that ceremony ends, they all start to cheer and yell.
Say something about virgins.
And actually, we wanted to send a very clear message to the radical element of Islam.
ألم تر كيف فعل ربك بأصحاب الفيل ألم يجعل كيدهم في تضليل وأرسل عليهم طيرا أبابيل ترميهم بحجارة من سجيل فجعلهم كعصف مأكول.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, it is we who sent down the Quran, and we watch over it, says God the Mighty, the Wise. Great Iranian nation, great Islamic Ummah, then saying revolting insult to the Holy Quran in America, an incident occurring under the security provided by the U.S. police, is a major tragic event that cannot be considered merely as the foolish act of a few worthless mercenaries. This is a calculated act by those who since years ago have put Islamophobic and anti-Muslim policies on their agenda and have tried to combat Islam and the Quran in numerous ways by resorting to myriad propaganda means and campaigns. This is another link in a chain of shameless measures launched with the blasphemy of Salman Rushdie, the apostate, followed by the insult of the base Danish caricaturist, tens of anti-Islamic movies produced in Hollywood, and now crowned by this disgusting show. Who and what is behind such evil acts? Looking into this trend of evil, as manifested in recent years in atrocious operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and Pakistan, leaves no doubt that it is designed and masterminded by heads of world imperialism and Zionist think tanks, which have the highest degree of influence in the governments, the military, and security agencies of the United States, as well as Britain and some other European countries. These are the ones at whom the finger of suspicion of independent truth-finding groups and individuals is pointed in the case of the attack on the Twin Towers on September the 11th. The then President of the U.S., a criminal, was provided with the pretext to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. He declared a crusade and, reportedly, said yesterday that with the Church entering the stage of the crusade has truly begun. What is aimed at through the recent repulsive incident is, on the one hand, to take the confrontation with Islam and Muslims to the populace in the Christian community, to give it a religious coloring and entrenching it with religious zeal and sentiment by involving the Church and, on the other, to divert the attention of the Muslim nations, enraged and hurt by this hideous effrontery, from the issues and developments in the Muslim world and the Middle East. This vengeful act is not the beginning of a trend, but another stage in the long history of antagonizing Islam, headed by Zionism and the U.S. government. Now all the heads of world hegemony and impiety are ranked against Islam. Islam is the religion of human liberation and spirituality, and the Quran is the book of compassion, wisdom, and justice. It is incumbent upon all free-spirited people of the world and all the followers of the Abrahamic religions to side with the Muslims in countering this heinous anti-Islamic policies and acts. Empty, deceitful words cannot exonerate the leaders of the U.S. government from this charge of involvement in this ugly phenomenon. For years, those things held sacred by millions of oppressed Muslims in Afghanistan and Pakistan, in Iraq, in Lebanon and Palestine, have been desecrated, all the rights and the dignity trampled on. Hundreds of thousands have been killed, tens of thousands of men and women captured and tortured, thousands of children and women kidnapped, and millions injured and made homeless. All victimized for what? And with these wrongs, why does the Western media represent Muslims as violence incarnate and Islam and the Quran as a menace to humanity? How can one believe that this vast conspiracy could be made possible without the support and involvement of the Zionist circles in the U.S. government? O Muslim brethren and sisters in Iran and all over the world, it is necessary to draw the attention of all to the following points. First, this incident and similar ones show that what is now being targeted by the global hegemony and world imperialism are the very foundations of the dear Islam and the Holy Quran. They manifest enmity of the arrogant world powers towards the Islamic Republic of Iran. The claim of the end of Islam is a big lie, a satanic Islam. Whoever believes in it, and whatever blacks against Islam and Muslims, the light of Islam has been shining brighter in the world and even in the West. Stems from the fact that Islamic Ummah to free itself of the shackles of two centuries of colonialism and interference. The incident of insulting the Quran and the great prophet of Islam, despite all its bitterness, bears great tidings. The bright sun of the Quran will shine brighter than ever. Third, we should all know that this incident has nothing to do with Christianity and the Church. A few foolish and mercenary priests, as those of Christians and churchmen. We Muslims will never commit similar acts against what is held sacred in other religions. Conflict between Muslims and Christians, on a popular scale, is what our enemies and the stages of this insane show are after. What the Quran teaches us is diametrically opposed to this. Fourth, today the protests of all Muslims are directed at the U.S. government and American politicians. If they are honest in their claim of not being involved in this, they must duly punish the main planners and operators of this heinous crime who have hurt the feelings of 1.5 billion Muslims the world over. And peace is on him who follows piety. Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
So why does Israel engage in such terror? How is it that an innocent people subjected to terrible Nazi Holocaust in the Second World War came to implement a similar Holocaust in Palestine? The answer to this question lies in the ideology known as Zionism. This ideology was put forward at the end of the 19th century by the Austrian Jewish journalist Theodor Herzl. Zionism was a nation-state ideology which aimed at the foundation of an independent Jewish state. The reason for this depended on the colonialist and social Darwinist theories which dominated 19th century Europe. According to these theories, the industrialized nations of the West had the right to colonize less developed nations. This was envisioned as a natural result of the concept of the struggle for survival between nations predicted by Darwinism. The Jews who put forward the idea of Zionism approved of this 19th century European error and constructed their own ideologies in the light of it. That is why racism became a part of Zionist ideology. These words by the famous Israeli leader Isaac Shamir about the Palestinian people are an open expression of this racism. It is unacceptable that nations made up of people who have only just come down from the trees should take themselves for world leaders. How can such primitive beings have an opinion of their own? Menachem Begin, who took part in bloody terrorist attacks in the 1940s and later became Prime Minister of Israel, had no compunctions about referring to the Palestinians as two-legged animals. Radical Zionists were only able to reconcile their consciences with this slaughter by denying that the Palestinians were human. It is this racist ideology that is responsible for the oppression that has gone on in Palestinian lands for the last half century. At the same time, the Zionists employ such concepts from Judaism as the chosen people and the promised land. This, however, is not a sincere religious devotion. On the contrary, Judaism, a divine religion, has become a vehicle for Zionism, a worldly ideology. The problem is not Judaism and the Jews, but rather Zionism and the Zionists. The relationship between Zionism and Judaism has never been a realistic one. Those who put forward the ideology of Zionism were people who had nothing to do with religion. Max Nordau, the second important movement leader after Herzl, was a confirmed atheist. Most devout Jews regarded Zionism as an anti-religious ideology and rejected it. Devout Jews still regard Zionism in those terms today. Someone walking about in devout areas of Jerusalem can see slogans written up to the effect that Judaism and Zionism are diametrically opposed. These devout Jews oppose Zionism. They carry slogans protesting the Zionist Israeli policy. This image is of Jews protesting against Israel's Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982. The placards they carry reveal the Zionist violence. All of this show that there is a huge gulf between Israeli terror and Judaism. In fact, it is quite impossible for a sincere, devout Jew to oppress other peoples. Although the basis of the religion, the Torah, has become interspersed with human words and corrupted since its revelation, it nevertheless commands peace and justice between people. For these reasons, devout Jews criticize Israeli terror as a violation of the Torah. One of these is Britain's chief rabbi, Professor Jonathan Sacks, who criticized the way that Israeli policy is treated as equivalent to Judaism in a statement he made in 2002. There are things that happen on a daily basis which makes me feel very uncomfortable as a Jew, he said. Even some Israeli soldiers oppose the government's harsh policies. In 2002, some 250 Israeli soldiers refused to serve in the occupied territories, saying, "We do not want to attack innocent people."
The Zionists are taking this terrible, horrific tragedy that happened by Jews, and they're using it to further their rebellion against God.
می‌دانیم که حساب جامعه یهود غیر حساب جامعه اونها هستن و ما با اونها مخالف هستیم و مخالفتمون برای این است که اونها با همه ادیان مخالف هستن. اونها یهودی نیستن، اونها یه مردم سیاسی هستن که به اسم یهودی یه کارهایی را میکنن و یهودی ها هم از اونها متنفر هستن و همه انسان ها